Today's episode is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/atheistnomads. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/atheistnomads. We are the Atheist Nomads, bringing you history, science, politics, religion, and interviews with leaders in the atheist community. Not all those who wander are lost. Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. This is episode 26, Bouncing Around with Jay Novella, recorded on April 22, 2013, and April 27, 2013, for release on May 2nd, 2013. I am Dustin, and joining me as always is Wesley.
How you doing? How you doing? How you doing?
Doing good, actually. Tomorrow's my birthday.
Yay!
Yeah, I got a party because there's three of us here in the local atheist community that all have birthdays back to back. Actually, there's a few more, but the other ones are apparently just doing their own thing. But yeah, there's three of us
splitters.
That
we're
doing. Starting at 2:30 today at the Boise Zoo, and then continuing on probably until they shut down the bars. It's going to be long and awesome.
So how old?
I'll be 29.
Hey.
Yeah.
29 for the third straight year.
No, 29 for the first time.
All right.
Yeah. I was born in 84, so that's works out to 29 years ago.
Okay.
And I actually haven't been to the Boise Zoo since I was probably about 7 years old. So it'll be kind of nice to see what they've done in the last 22 years there. I hear it's so much better. You know, back then it was mostly just cages, and now it's more proper, more natural-like enclosures.
Cool.
Yeah. So how about you, Wesley? I hear you took a trip recently.
That was the best freaking $300 I ever spent. Man. Yeah, $300. I fly to Kansas. Meet up with Amanda and Adam and everybody in SOMA, which that's the Society of Open-Minded Atheists and Agnostics, but, you know, I won't count them. Anyways, yeah, amazing conference called Reason Fest. This is their third one that they've done. It's a free conference. If you haven't went, you should go. I know they'll have another one. They're already talking about it. I mean, so check this out. We got Nate Phillips, Greta Christina, Matt Dillahunty, David Fitzgerald, JT Eberhardt, Bridget Goddett, Michael and Ilya, Seth Anders, the thinking atheist. I just like saying that. Keith Lowell Jensen, badass comic, Teresa McBain, Jerry DeWitt, Dave Moscato from American Atheist, and how could I forget Shelley Segal? Oh, my goodness.
God damn.
Half these people we've already talked to, the other half we're gonna talk to. Dr. Daryl Ray. The talks were amazing. I posted this on Facebook, but, Nate Phelps, you know, he was talking about his story, his childhood, how he grew up, and, you know, he just couldn't agree with it. And when he was 18, when he was finally legally able to leave, he did. He snuck out one night out on his 18th birthday, as I recall, and it just, you know, his upbringing really struck a chord with me. And you know, I was kind of, I actually couldn't stop crying for, like, you know, during the whole thing and like an hour afterwards. I was just stupid, but I was just fucked up. You know, he's an amazing speaker. Great guy. Boy, oh boy. Anyways, the students in SOMA, I wanted to give a quick shout because they were just awesome. Like Maria, Ashley, Nevin, James, Christina, Marilyn, and lots of others that just helped keep everything running smoothly. It was just an amazing time, and I got to hang out with, like, all my heroes, and so fucking A, I was just kind of enjoying the shit out of it, you could say. That plus, you know, I was honestly getting about 2 hours of sleep every night, so there might have been a little extra euphoria in there somewhere. And yeah, it's fucking free. I mean, it Northwest Free Thought, doors were blown off. You know, there's no way that the NW Free Thought could have compared to that.
Yeah, I'd imagine by the sounds of it.
Man, an amazing panel discussion between a Christian, a Jew, and a Muslim, and JT Eberhard. There's another one with a father-son Christian tag team, and JT and Matt. And the Christians just got, like, completely fucked in the debate. They were just tearing themselves apart, and Matt and JT were having fun helping them with it. And they didn't even realize that they were getting smacked down.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, great fucking time. Worth the money, because it's fucking free. Go next year.
Okay, we have our first ever listener contest. Wesley, would you like to tell us about the prize?
All right. So when Shelley was in town up in Tacoma a couple weeks ago now, I bought another copy of an Atheist album. This one, I had her autograph it to a special guest of the amazing, incredible, magnificent, stupendous podcast, Atheist Nomads. Best wishes, Shelley Segal.
Yeah, tell us why it's important to be an out atheist, and you have to do this in no more than 500 words if you're writing it out, or 3 minutes if it's audio. And this could be submitted by email.
I think we'd prefer the audio.
Yes, we definitely would prefer audio.
We'd love to play it on here for everybody to hear.
You can either email it to us at contact@atheistnomads.com, or you could just phone it in on the voicemail line at 541-203-0666. The deadline for this is going to be May 11, 2013. So that's just a little over a week of when I'm hoping to get this released. And we will be listening to the submissions or reading them as they come in, and we will be kind of ranking them on the go. So that way, right by the end of that, we will have it all decided, and when we next record, we can make that the announcement of who the winner is.
Yeah, and once it's announced, we'll contact you and get your address. I'll mail it out to you.
Probably the best way would be phone in the audio and send us an email with your contact information.
And if you don't send us an email with your contact info and you leave a voicemail, just make sure you leave your phone number in there also.
Definitely.
So yeah, we got some feedback from Vance, my buddy Vance. If you don't mind, I'll just go ahead and read it.
Sounds good.
All right. I just listened to this episode yesterday. I need to take better note of when the live broadcast happened so I can watch timely. I just can't get over the story of North Carolina wanting to declare state religion, that it sends an exclusionary message to people of other faiths and non-believers who incidentally also pay taxes to hear that their worldview matters less. It just makes my blood boil. North Carolina is turning into one of those states, well, like my state of Arizona, that it only makes the news when something bad happens. In the Southwest, we have people in the upper ranks of state politics who are young earth creationists, and it wasn't that long ago, relatively speaking, that a friend of mine was posting on her timeline to the effect of, "I live in North Carolina where I can marry my opposite sex cousin, but not another woman." Anyway, marriage equality wasn't the point this time, and I'm listening for any follow-up of the state religion issue, for closure, hopefully, and an Atheist Nomads and Free Thought Radio.
There's not likely to be any follow-up coming on this, because it was dead from the start. This was just a couple of jackasses proposing legislation.
And, to score points.
Yeah, to score points with their far right-wing constituents.
Yeah.
And when you have the Speaker of the House saying this will never see a vote, that means it is dead.
This is just one of those cases where these assholes are trying to score political points with their voting bloc and say, hey, you know what, look, at least I tried. And ew, what an asshole.
Yeah, pretty much.
So thankfully, Vance, you shouldn't ever hear about this one again. And if you do, it's because we're like, they actually got it to a fucking vote, but that won't happen. I mean, even in North Carolina, there's a few people with cooler heads that shall prevail.
Mm-hmm. And typically to get to a position like Speaker of the House, even in a state legislature, you need to have at least some kind of a head on your shoulders. Getting elected to a state legislature, on the other hand, the bar tends to be pretty low, but Speaker of the House, it is a much higher bar. I'm not knocking local politics at all, but yeah, the bar can be quite low.
You got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And even for upper politics, it's still pretty damn low.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much all you have to be is, well, a lawyer, and you can get elected.
A lawyer with the right friends.
Yeah, but, I mean, if you look at our federal level, they're, like, massively overwhelmingly lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
No scientists, no engineers, nobody with, like, a decent... I know there's a few, but still, that's surprising how few.
Now, it wasn't too long ago that the Senate Majority Leader was a doctor.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Trent Lott, if I remember correctly.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oregon's current governor is a medical doctor, or maybe he's a dentist. One or the other.
Well,
so it does happen, but it's not often.
I seem to recall Bobby Jindal being a very highly educated man, too.
Mm-hmm.
And he's now, or always was, a young Earth creationist.
Yeah.
So.
Well, now you got Republicans trying to look for Ben Carson to run for president.
Hmm.
And he's a very accomplished, very skilled neurosurgeon. But a Seventh-day Adventist.
That's made some pretty fucking...
He's a Seventh-day Adventist and a young Earth creationist.
He's said some pretty fucking stupid things recently, too.
Yeah. Anyway, let's go ahead and move on. We've got lots of news to get to.
Gonna keep this day in history short. This day in history, May 2nd, 2011, Osama bin Laden was killed. He was hiding out in a fairly decent compound in Pakistan. When the place was raided, turns out that a couple people along with him were killed, one of them being his oldest son, as I recall. It's two teams of SEAL teams went in there. One of the helicopters actually had a crash landing when they went in there. Fucking, you know, nobody was hurt. Pretty much, you know, even with all the bad luck that happened getting in there, everything went down pretty damn smoothly. No Americans were hurt. Yeah, shit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really want to say hooray. I don't really want to say boo, but it's a thing and it happened. So that's pretty much it for history.
Alrighty. Time for science and technology.
Yes, please.
And we're going to start with one that kind of blurs the line between technology and politics. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed CISPA, and this is a very bad thing. This is the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, and it's one that allows for any company to give private user data to the government with complete immunity.
Totally not cool.
Yeah. The different versions of this keep on getting proposed, and they've ranged from requiring companies like ISPs, for example, to monitor all of your data so they can share it with the government. This one just seems to be that they're free to, and they're immune, and that's complete and utter bullshit. This is a huge, huge civil liberties issue.
Definitely. I mean, I'm surprised the EEF hasn't already, you know, been even more vocal about it.
Oh, they've been talking about this one for every time it comes up.
Yeah.
But it passed in the House 288-127.
Motherfuckers.
It's now headed to the Senate, where last time around it, you know, died there. It also has a veto threat from President Obama.
It damn better. It's always been my thought that the House of Representatives get some really stupid shit passed.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate at least kind of reins it back in sometimes.
Yeah.
But fuck.
Oh, this was a case where I've subscribed to my congressman's weekly newsletter.
Yep.
And in the same newsletter had something he did that I strongly oppose, like voting for CISPA. Fucking douchebag. And petitioning, I forgot which federal agency it was, but asking them to consider financial compensation to farmers that lose livestock to wolves and bears.
That's, well, they didn't say aliens.
That's a move that actually makes sense. You know, if Yeah. Since we're reinstating wolf and bear populations in many areas in the U.S., especially places like Idaho and Montana, where there's a lot of agriculture, those large predators were killed by people to protect livestock. And if they can create a system to make it so that farmers can get compensation, then there's going to be less resistance to those animals having sustainable populations. But even with far-right-wing Republican legislators, you get some good ideas and a hell of a lot of bad ideas. Oh, fuck. All right, moving on.
All right.
Commander Chris Hadfield in the of Expedition 35 at the International Space Station, he's been taking questions from school children. And one of them is, what happens if you wring a washcloth in space? And there's a link to the article on Discovery.com with a video of him doing this demonstration. And it is really cool to watch.
Really messy.
Yeah, but not what you'd expect. Unless you're really smart. But yeah, definitely check this out. It's pretty cool. Astronomers looking at data from the Kepler Observatory have found two planets that are surprisingly Earth-like, at least as far as size goes. Now, these are the most Earth-like planets that have been found. They are orbiting a yellowish star, a little smaller than our sun. They're a lot closer to their star because it's cooler than our sun, but they are in the habitable zone. And they're within about 1.5 times the size of the Earth. So you've got approximately the right gravity for life, and you've got the right temperatures for life. The big question would be, what else is on it? Does it have water? Does it have carbon? Do you have all the elements for life? Do you have life there?
And even for the team, I mean, usually once any group of scientists releases something to the public, to the news outlets, it usually gets warped. And, you know, it's like, okay, maybe we found something decent. Then it gets the media, and the media is like, they found something really awesome. And then it gets spread out from there. But, you know, just to even have, like, here it is, William Baricki of NASA's Ames Research Institute, head of the Kepler project, described one of the worlds as the best site for life out there yet. In Kepler's 4 years and counting search, he actually treated his team to pizza and beer on his own dime. I mean, he says it's that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Even they're excited.
Yes.
So this is something that, you know, it hasn't been, you know, brought up by other people's standards to make it sound amazing. It actually is quite possibly amazing.
Now, there is one catch here that will make it difficult for us to ever find out what's actually there.
Distance?
It's 1,200 light years away.
Yeah,
it's going to be a little difficult.
You know, I'm sure those broadcasts of Hitler from the Olympics should be getting there by now or something. Maybe, probably not.
No. Yeah, they wouldn't be getting any broadcasts for about 1,100 years.
That's too bad, because we'll be dead by then.
Yeah.
I mean, Earth.
And then we might get something back from them about 1,200 years later. All right, moving on.
All right.
AquaVantage salmon is approaching FDA approval. And this is a genetically altered salmon that has uses growth hormone from... Oh, it's based on the Atlantic salmon. And it has growth hormone from the Chinook salmon, which works with a promoter that's coming from genes from ocean pout, which is an eel-like fish. And so it is a transgenic fish. The data on it shows that it is virtually indistinguishable from regular Atlantic salmon as far as the meat goes. It is safe, which is why it's approaching this approval. But you're getting a lot of pushback on it, on some what I would say are some worthy considerations. In particular,
okay,
what if this gets loose on the environment?
Okay,
you've got a salmon that can grow twice as fast as wild Atlantic salmon. It could easily outcompete.
One thing is, all these fish tanks that the pens that they're in are way inland. There's no river, no water for them to escape into. And second, as I recall, they're infertile.
Well, the bulk of them are, but about 1% of them have to be fertile to produce the eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And so Yeah, 99% are going to be infertile, but you're going to have about 150,000 at any time that are fertile.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, personally, I'm always leery of farmed fish. Some of the safety concerns of those are, you know, if it's a mercury contaminated pool that it's in, it's going to be horribly, horribly contaminated fish. It's like lake stock trout. If it's a lake that's got mercury, it's inedible. And with wild salmon, even if it is coming in contact with large amounts of mercury and other toxins, it's moving through so much water that its exposure time is so low that you have some natural built-in safety safety measures there. So sure. I would hope that they do have really good controls for mercury content and the like. But this is something that I wouldn't have an inherent objection to eating this.
Well, I mean, like 66% of the salmon that's eaten out there between, what does it say, between 2000 and 2004, Americans ate 284 million tons of salmon annually, and about 66% of that was farmed.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing that you're really changing in this little circle is that they're transgenic.
Well, and because they're transgenic, you can produce more meat off of less feed.
Yeah, because these salmon grow all year round. That's their biggest claim to fame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So honestly, I don't really have a problem with it.
The science seems.
I kind of look at this as GM crops.
Mm-hmm. The science seems sound. Yep. Safety looks good. So I don't have any serious objections.
Foundation Beyond Belief is a community of compassionate humanists and atheists supporting outstanding charities worldwide. Members sign up for automatic donations starting at $5 a month, then distribute those funds however they wish among the featured charities. To date, this unique humanist organization has raised over $750,000 to make this world a better, more humane place. We don't look to the skies for a better world. Foundation Beyond Belief is humanity at work. Learn more or join us at foundationbeyondbelief.org.
Time for politics and religion. All right. By now, everybody has probably gotten really sick of hearing about the Boston Marathon and the bombing that occurred there. So really all I want to say is those who lost loved ones, were injured, or lost appendages from the marathon definitely have my condolences. And I do want to acknowledge that this was a case of Islamic extremism, and it does show some of the major horrifying shit. What's the wording I'm looking for? You need religion to get people, most of the time, you need religion to get people to do stuff this horrific. Yeah. Religion can take a good person and turn them horribly, horribly bad. It once you shut down the natural, rational thought processes to a part of your life, you don't have any check on that. You're shutting down the checks and balances and making sure that what you're doing is a decent thing to do. But nobody should be going after Muslims because of something that a couple of Muslims did. Yes, religion is bad. Yes, Islam is currently one of the leading types of religion to be used to promote very, very evil actions. But that doesn't mean that all Muslims are bad. Most are very good, peaceful people.
I've always thought that the moderates enabled the extremists, and maybe it's time for them to speak up a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't have any objection to that. All right. Moving on. A Turkish pianist, Fazıl Say, got a suspended 10-month jail term for mocking Islam on Twitter. Turkey is a secular nation, and yet blasphemy laws are sneaking in. You have other moves there with the Turkish airline suggesting some new or proposing some new flight attendant uniforms that are very Ottoman style and cover everything. You know, basically covers the flight attendant from chin to toe.
Hmm.
There are old churches from the Christian era in that part of the world that were converted into mosques when the Ottoman Turks threw out the Byzantines. And many of those have now become museums, and museums that are open to everybody in the public, many of which are considered Christian heritage sites. Well, those are beginning to be turned back into mosques and being only open to Muslim men.
Which is standard for
any mosques. Yeah. Or at least a lot of mosques. They're imposing censorship on TV shows as well. This is one of those things that is, it's kind of scary to see. Coming from Faruk Logolu, the CHP party vice chairman, "We are very concerned because Turkey is a secular democracy, but Islam has become the only reference. It says what to do, what to wear, what to eat, what not to eat."
Not good.
No.
Looking a little scary.
Yeah.
Good luck over there, Farouk. Many people out there might have heard about Roger Gourley recently. really nice guy. And he's the father of my friend Amanda Brown. when his partner was hospitalized recently, Roger tried to go in there and see him, and, you know, just like anybody else would. I mean, your husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, friend, even, you know, they're in the hospital. You want to, you know, comfort them, say, hey, sneak them in a cheeseburger. But, you know, they've been together and married for 5 years, but it's not recognized in Kansas. So yeah, when Ellen was in the hospital, his family's in there, and the Ellen's family actually keeps Roger out of the hospital. They keeps him out of the room, and Roger ends up, you know, understandably so, getting pissed, getting excited, and trying to get it in there, you know, and he ends up getting arrested. He just wanted to be at his partner's side. I mean, how is that wrong? It's just not wrong at all. I mean, that's kind of really fucking pisses me off.
Mm-hmm.
When I was out there for Reason Fest, I met Roger. Awesome guy. Really nice. I met Alan too. And, you know, they were just dudes. They were cool. They were nice. Man, people I'd like to hang out with. And to know that between Alan's family, between the police that arrested him, kind of makes me rage a little bit. But, Amanda, she's been writing about this, about this whole situation on weareatheism.com. And, you know, after Roger got arrested, you know, there's legal bills, there's already medical bills that they're having problems with. But, you know, if you can spare a few bucks, it'd be really appreciated if you could go over and subscribe or donate. You know, I know it sounds cliche, but even a buck will help.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, fucking hey, kick in and help these guys out. They can sure use it.
Yeah. What's makes this sound like a slam dunk lawsuit to me is just the fact that the person that Alan had given power of attorney to, you know, the person has legal rights and responsibilities for medical decisions, was thrown out of the hospital. That in and of itself, the hospital staff ignored the stated wishes of the patient.
Yeah, it shouldn't give a goddamn what the relationship is between the people. You're completely right. Ellen gave Roger power of attorney.
Roger was the one who knew about the medical conditions, the history and all of that, not Alan's brother and sister-in-law. And it is just completely and utterly fucked up. I really hope that they file lawsuits against the hospital, the nurse that was involved, and the police department. They all seriously fucked up. Pure and simple.
Yeah, but if there is going to be a legal case, I don't know, but between then and now, there sure is a lot of help that, you know, could sure be sent their way. So, help them out, please. Man, this is our Kansas episode. Ooh, doggy.
We're leaving Kansas now.
Okay, Dorothy.
State I've actually never been to.
Kansas or Texas?
Either.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, my only experience in Texas is the Houston airport, and that doesn't count, but never even landed in Kansas. I don't know if I've even flown over Kansas. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, so, yeah, now we're at Texas. The Boy Scouts have established a new proposal for trying to fix their growing PR issue with how they treat gay scouts. And this new one is to allow gay scouts, but not gay leaders.
Of course, because, you know, those are actually ideas. Being gay is an idea. It's like a virus or a meme. It can transfer just by skin contact, even sometimes, or not.
Oh, fuck. This is just, it's
way too little, way too late.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yes, if they allow gay scouts, that's a step. Might I just say, what about gay atheist scouts? They still wouldn't be allowed.
Yeah. What I think this is really showing is that the Boy Scouts need to figure out what their identity is. Are they an organization that is inherently religious, or are they a national organization? And if they're going to be going with inherently religious and they can do whatever the hell they want, but they better stop taking money from the government and they better stop getting preferential treatment from the military for scouts that enlist or apply to service academies or ROTC.
Right.
Or they need to drop all of the religious bullshit and accept all Americans.
And I'm completely fine if they want to go private. They can say whatever they want to, whenever they want to, essentially. But yeah, just like you said, no more public money.
Mm-hmm. Right now they're trying to have their cake and eat it too, and they're finding that is very difficult to do. If they do become fully accepting of gay members, they're going to lose a lot of the religious backing.
Yep, which is, their religious backing is almost completely Mormon-backed,
mm-hmm.
from what I've seen.
Yeah.
For some reason, Mormons just don't like gay people.
Yeah. Okay, the government made them accept blacks. They have to have somebody to hate, somebody to feel superior over.
Yeah, if you're not white and delightsome, just who cares? God, get out of here.
All right.
That's a Mormon reference. Let me put that out there. I stole that one from Brian Keith Dalton.
All right. So we got a few more stories along these same lines. All the major sports leagues, such as the National Hockey League, National Football League, National Basketball Association, they are beginning to take steps towards, Major League Soccer. That's the other one. They're beginning to take steps towards preparing for out gay athletes. It is surprising that considering how many athletes you have between all those different leagues, that there isn't already one. But so far, all the gay athletes are in the closet. The National Hockey League has been taking some of the strongest, steps towards preparing for this, working with gay advocacy groups and creating training programs for new recruits into their league to make sure that they're prepared for having gay team members, and creating just all kinds of programs to help facilitate this process. The NFL has kind of an unofficial spokesman for acceptance of gay players with Brendan Ian the day Joe.
I don't watch sports either. I don't know.
Okay, something. Yeah. Anyway, he knows several gay players and is trying to work with them to do what they want to do, what's right for them. And
shouldn't be hidden, but I don't even know why this is a thing. Yeah. Why are people so surprised that there's gay players?
Well, the stereotype is that...
Oh, yeah. Me, big, strong man.
Yeah. Big, yeah, strong, okay. Straight, macho man and effeminate gay man.
Yeah.
Those are the stereotypes. That doesn't quite fit because there are effeminate straight men and macho gay men. But, yeah, it is what it is. And fortunately, they're taking steps to
As long as they don't get worried about it and make, like, you know, separate bathrooms and shit.
Yeah.
But it does explain the whole spanking each other on the ass thing as you walk by. Makes you think.
But when you look at it, especially with the NFL, out of these leagues, you get a lot of the more conservative elements of society watching these sports. And when they start finding they have players they like that are gay, that could help change some minds.
Yeah, totally.
You know, just like how with the civil rights movement for ethnic minorities, desegregating the military and desegregating sports were majorly important steps towards progress in society. Same thing's happening now with the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and with athletic leagues working to assist out gay players. And
well,
next,
good on them for trying, I guess.
A couple in Pennsylvania have been on probation for the 2009 death of a toddler of theirs because they turned to prayer instead of a doctor. And one of the terms of that probation was that they had to take their children for regular checkups by doctors, and anytime there's a medical issue, they would have to take their children to a doctor.
Yep.
Well, since going on probation, they had another child, an 8-month-old named Brandon, who got diarrhea and breathing problems that lasted for about a week, and then he stopped eating. And did they take him to a doctor? No. They stuck with faith healing.
Bastards.
And their son died.
Another one.
Another one died.
Yep.
Last time around, they were charged with involuntary manslaughter, and they're waiting on the autopsy results to determine what charges to actually go with this time. But this is incredibly... This is so infuriating. A child, one of their children died in their care because they were relying on prayer. They had such a strong and clear personal example of how well that works when their son died. And did they make any changes? No, they didn't. They continued to stick with their same failed methods. And why the hell did the courts let them keep custody of their children?
Yeah, other children.
They'd already had a child die in their care due to their gross negligence. They shouldn't be getting charged with involuntary manslaughter. They should be getting charged with criminally negligent homicide.
Hey, yo, fucking A.
The judge that let them keep custody, he needs to get fired, if not thrown in prison himself.
I'm fine
with
that, too.
Maybe he should be facing charges for criminally negligent, or not criminally negligent, for involuntary manslaughter. This is just fucking ridiculous.
Children hadn't been taken for checkups as they were supposed to. This baby that died, he saw a doctor when he was 10 days old, but they didn't know if the kid had been seen by a doctor since then. I mean, these people are on probation. They need to take their kids in for regular checkups. This is months and months. Where's the fucking caseworker in this also?
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Fucking A. They need to get smacked down too.
Yeah. And they...
Oh, you're pissed.
Yeah. What I think really needs to happen to these people is they need to be locked up until their youngest surviving child is at least 18 years of age and sterilized so that they can't have any more children to kill.
Nah, fuck that. I'm fine with them being in prison for forever. I would help pay my taxes just so they could, you know, stay in jail. Yeah, fuck that. Fuck them.
Yeah. Ah, god damn. This involuntary manslaughter, my ass. That is going way too soft on them. And
god damn
just
right
probation.
It is.
Ugh. Yeah, I'm pissed.
All right, well, fucking A.
Ah. Let's stick with bad news before we end with a good one.
Okay.
So reordering it just a little bit.
Sure.
A Russian court on April 26 rejected a plea for parole for one of the lead members of Pussy Riot, Nadia Tolokonova.
Oh. Nadia Tolokonova.
Okay.
Tolokonova. Tolokonivova. Fuck.
Anyway, yeah, Nadia. They rejected her plea for parole. She's been in custody since her arrest in March after their protest. And some of the other members of the band have been released, but she's being held for a 2-year sentence in a penal colony. In a Russian penal colony where she's doing hard labor. Wow. Who knew labor camps still existed?
And she probably could have been released early or had a reduced sentence, but she hasn't repented. You know, so I give her props for that.
Mm-hmm.
Shit.
Yeah. You know, and some of the other things they've listed as penalties she's had as grounds for her not getting parole is she failed to say hello to a prison official when she was in the hospital.
Oh, okay.
And she refused to go a walk once when she was in the Moscow jail.
Hmm.
Ah, goddamn.
Seriously? That's what they got?
Yeah.
Okay.
Fuck. Ugh. All right, let's move to some happier news. The Icelandic Parliament, the Althing, which has the coolest name of any legislative body. Also, if I remember correctly, it is the oldest legislative body that's currently in existence.
Misa, you live in Iceland. I'm sure you could tell us.
Who does?
Misa.
You fucker. Iceland and Finland are not the same.
Just leave it in. just that line. Just leave. Yeah. Oh boy.
Anyway, they've passed a new law giving any life stance organizations equal status. So the Ethical Humanist Association now gets the same treatment as all non-official churches.
Yay.
Yeah. So that's definitely a step footing in the right direction. However, the Evangelical Lutheran State Church still gets major legal and financial privileges over everybody else.
Of course.
At least
but
secular,
it's still their state religion.
Yeah, but at least secular organizations aren't given tertiary status. They at least now have full secondary status.
Yeah, they're tier two, just like every other church that's not the state religion.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, actually kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. And that's it for news.
Yay.
And then what would you say about doing the music at the end?
Sure.
All right.
Can try it out once, yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly, I don't really have much of a problem with that at all.
Cool. Joining us now is Jay Novella. Jay is a skeptical activist and has been doing that for about 15 years. He serves as the co-host of Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and it's a very popular science and skepticism podcast. He's also the producer and director for SGU Video Productions that you can find on YouTube, and the director of marketing and technology for the New England Skeptical Society. Jay, welcome to Atheist Nomads.
Hey guys, thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. As I recall, weren't you also the Ock, the skeptical caveman?
I played Cooter, the somewhat mentally challenged you know, Southern guy, yeah. We got a lot of flack about that character, by the way. I don't know if you guys know about that.
I'm sure he wasn't Southern, and yeah, I'm familiar with the blowback.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. I mean, we were a little surprised because I've said it on the show a few times. Like, we play a lot of – I tabletop a lot with my friends. Like, we play all sorts of different, like, Vampire the Masquerade, Dungeons & Dragons, Pathfinder. You know, we're – this is like what I find to be the most entertaining and free thing I can possibly do, right? It's like I could sit in a room with my friends for 12 hours and just literally laugh the whole time making fun of each other while we play these role-playing games. And that character was one of those characters. He came up in a game that one of my friends wanted to run. It was like, you know, he just had this really funny plot line, and he's like, I need you to play like this really weird, like Southern guy. Can you do it? I'm like, yeah, I got 15 characters like flying through my head right now. That's the one I used. And then when we were casting the Octa Skeptical Caveman pilot, like we're just coming up with character ideas. Doug, who plays Ock, Doug Sobin, said, why don't you use like the Cooter character? Like, that guy is like off the rails. He's really funny. I'm like, oh, really? All right, sure. So I read the script with that character and it just happened. So we were just like, oh my God, this is great. You know, I never thought for a minute that people would, you know, would be actually offended, or, you know, like, you shouldn't, you know, making Southern people look like they're morons or whatever. This is just a stupid character for me that didn't really matter what the accent was. I mean, I could have just as easily been talking like a Guido or whatever, you know?
It's all good, man. It's all good.
But you're not, you guys aren't mad at me?
Nah, fucking no.
Oh, good. Okay. So, if, not from Oregon. Good. All right. Fine. Good enough. It's, yeah. It's good enough.
I'm not even sure what a Guido is.
That's half of me, and I think almost all of you, Jay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm mostly Italian. Yeah, I mean, but a real Guido is like, you know, someone that's from Brooklyn or, you know, Jersey. You know, the gold wearing, you know, gold chains, really, you know, hairy Italian guy that just is driving a, you know, like a, what was the big one? They like Corvettes, and what was the other one? El Caminos, all that stuff.
Oh, okay.
IROC Z. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, you know it.
But those IROC Zs in the Northwest, it's mostly rednecks and white trash.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's like it's the poor guy's sports car.
Mm-hmm.
But they tricked him out pretty, you know, like back in the 80s, late 70s and 80s, like that was the ride.
Nice.
So what, now tell me about your podcast, guys. What's your audience like? Who are we talking to right now?
We are at about 1,100 listeners now. Best we can tell from our audience, we've got people listening from several different countries, but we do have at least one listener in Finland. Few in England, I think somebody in Australia.
And the United States is all over. There's no real where is this coming from? There's no like distinct regions.
Yeah. Like, do you have any idea what your demographic is? Is it mostly, like what age range or anything like that?
I'll tell you from the responses we're getting that it's about 30% women. So that, yeah. I was kind of surprised. Yeah.
And as far as age range, everything from college young age to retirement.
Yeah. Isn't that's what my podcasting is awesome. Like that's not typical with like a terrestrial radio show with these types of podcasts that we do.
Mm-hmm.
You're just going to get random people of all age ranges and everywhere downloading your show and listening to it. I don't know why. I don't know if it's just the accessibility that makes it so the age range goes crazy, but like, you know, when you think of like the people that are listening to specific terrestrial radio shows, like they don't get like a 60-year spectrum in their age range.
Yeah.
But podcasts do. And I think that's awesome.
Well, and different styles of podcasts can probably help with that because, you know, we cover on the political spectrum, we're a lot closer to the middle than most. So we end up reaching a specific segment of the population that don't find anybody talking with, you know, the same types of views that they have.
Yeah.
Plus the ones that are off on either side. And so that's kind of helpful. You guys definitely, I've noticed, try to keep off of politics.
Yeah, it was a decision we made early on when we were talking about like what the show, the content should be. And the original idea actually to do a podcast came from a friend of mine named Shane who wanted to do, like, he's like, I heard this podcast thing just came out. And he's like, why don't we do a show on politics or whatever? Because we have a lot of political conversation over email with all of our friends. And we get into like these 3-week email discussions that are, you know, if you don't start them from the beginning, you just can't even dare read them because it's just too much. You know, it's like hours of reading to sift through the whole thing. So right away, Steve's like, yeah, we're going to do the podcast, but we're not going to do a political podcast and you're not included. Like, we're going to do skepticism and we're going to, so we adopted his idea and just started doing a show literally less than a week later. We quickly pieced it together. I'm like, you know, I had been in a band for 21 years and I knew sound reinforcement. So, you know, we got the gear together very quickly and it was terrible, of course. Like, the sound quality was horrible. But we decided, like, that week, you know, we don't want to talk about religion. We don't want to talk about politics. Only when they crisscross science and critical thinking are we going to bring them up. And it's just, you know, it's worked well for us because we can get a lot of a huge variety of people listening to the show that we don't immediately piss off, you know, by saying, you know, we're Republican, we're Democrat, we're, you know, we're X, Y, or Z. Like, it's more of the science that matters. And to be honest with you, at this point, you know, I'm just so much more into science than I am politics now. Like, I don't even want to even talk about politics anymore because I'm just disgusted with the whole thing. You know, I'm just like, the answer is science. You have a political problem, focus on the science. Put more money into science. Like, because everything else that they're talking about, to me, is nonsense.
Basically, I agree.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, there is really nothing more to say on that. I'm like, fucking A.
Yeah. Just, I can't fix the problem. I can't be a part of fixing the problem because I don't understand the problems anymore that they're having.
Mm-hmm.
And that scares me. You know, I just want to make the world a better place. And we have this fucking tool called science that can literally shoot people into outer space. You know, what's more powerful and cool than that? And on any way you look at it, like, you know, and the politicians in our world are like so obsessed with things that I don't attach myself to anymore emotionally. You know, and they take advantage of horrible things. Like, you know, we have this bombing that happened in Boston, and like I'm watching politicians talk about it as if they're involved in any way, or like, you know, like why because you're in that office do I have to hear you talk about a horrible event as if you have the answers? You're just some person that got elected. There's nothing special about them.
And the problem that I see with those people that got elected, they're all career politicians. How many are engineers? How many are doctors? How many are scientists of any sort? I think only one or two.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely people in Congress that have some background and you know, educations and other things or whatever. But in the end, it seems to me like they all become career politicians, and it becomes more about just staying in office than doing something in office. Yeah. You know, doing good with that power and everything. And it's built, you know, the corruption is just woven right in. It just makes perfect sense. Yeah. I give you money because you need it to keep your ass in that seat. And you just do me favors. And then you do that to 50 people. And next thing you know, like, you're doing no good.
Yeah. Well, so. And they completely forget critical thinking, and they just follow whatever the ideological values are and just plow that direction when they're completely missing the point.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unfortunate. Back in the 50s, I've said this story a few times, and it just was something that stuck with me when I heard it. There was a NPR journalist named Cokie Roberts.
Yeah.
I'm hoping I remember her name correctly. And she was saying, her dad was in the government in the 50s, and I believe he was a senator. And he said, you know, during the day, they would fight like cats and dogs. They were all, you know, very idealistic and wanted to you know, be successful in the goals that they were presenting, and, you know, full of fervor and enthusiasm. And at night, these guys were friends, and they'd go have dinner with each other, and they'd spend time with each other's families and everything. And it was more of like a mutual respect that they both were pushing maybe from different directions, but their hearts were typically in the same place, and they knew that about each other. They were real colleagues. Today, they actually hate each other. They actually try to drive each other into the ground. And that is, there's no better word than, it's just downright disgusting. Like, that's not the way our government should be working. This shouldn't be about, you know, untwisting the string here. It should, you know, they're not doing anything together. They're just undoing what the other person is doing. And I can't find anyone to give me a good argument about how that isn't exactly the case. So I don't know what to say other than it's all wrong now. It's just the whole premise of the way our government is working now is confrontational. It's not only when like 9/11 happened, we had 6 months of them working with each other. And now it's like, I don't know. And people are probably going to, you know, email you saying I'm so full of it, but I just, please show me how I'm wrong.
Well, all you have to do is look at the proposals that each party is putting forth. It's the same shit. It's just the Republicans will vote for it when it's proposed by a Republican. The Democrats will vote against it. And then 4 years later, the Democrats will propose the same exact thing, and the Republicans will vote against it while the Democrats will support it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's when I look at it from a science perspective, you know, you don't have to go through all these gyrations. Just let science fix problems, you know, empower the sciences that we already have to do the magic that it does. And, you know, it seems simple, but like that's not what the whole machine is about. It's just, it's about power and control now. And it's not about creating solutions. And it just drives me nuts. And it's not fun. That's the other thing. Like I don't talk about politics even in my personal life that much anymore, because it used to be interesting and intriguing and intellectually challenging. Because it's complex, and it's a very interesting system. But it's really cool if it's being used properly and just watching like the intrigue and trying to follow like what's happening. But today it's just garbage, and it hurts me. It actually is painful for me. So I'm just, whatever, you got that. I don't do religion now, and I don't do science. I don't do politics. All I've got left is like my family and science. So
that doesn't sound too bad.
Yeah.
Speaking of, you just had a little one not too long ago. How's that working out?
Yeah, so he's 11 weeks. And, you know, it's the thing, you know, for those of your audience that have had babies, like I think they'll identify with this. You hear people, your friends and family, you know, all the babies you come in contact before you have your own. And you hear people say, you just don't know. You just don't know until you have your own kid. And it's so freaking true, because I was ready for like the profound thing. I'm like, okay, I know that there's something epically hardwired here that I'm going to love. I don't really know what it is. Like, what's it going to be like? You know, like, I'm like, it can't be like when you get a pet, because you love the pet, but then you get over it pretty quickly, and they kind of, you know, just blend into the background after, you know, 6 months or whatever. You love them, but, you know, it's not like you don't get out of bed excited. I'm telling you guys, like, my son is so interesting and exciting to me. I've never looked at a baby so long and been, you know, and I'm the guy that was like, didn't get it. And now I see it from the other side. It's epic. It's epic. It's awesome. I love my son in a way that I've never felt like love before. It's not romantic love. It's not familial love. It is something else. And it's hardwired, and it's as awesome as breathing. You know, it's just like, oh my God, I love this. I get out of bed in the morning before I go to work, and I go into, you know, we have him in the crib already, and he's sleeping the whole night already. And it just happened this week, so I'm like actually getting some sleep again.
Oh, nice.
And I look at his face, and I'm telling you, like, I just melt every time I look at him. I melt. It's awesome. It's something. If you feel like, you know, you want to have kids, you're going to love it. You're absolutely going to love it. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me.
It sounds really awesome and really fucking scary at the same time.
It is. It's more scary, I think, before you do it, because none of the real puzzle pieces have even materialized, let alone fall into place. But after you do, like, the whole, I haven't slept for a month, and, you know, you wrap your head around, like, the changes that it invokes into your life. Like, it just absolutely demands that these changes happen. But, you know, if you're ready, and that's the thing, like, you know, if I were 20, I could never have done this. And I'm 45 this summer, you know, I'm turning into an older guy. I wish I did this. I wish I was ready for this when I was 30. I just wasn't there in my life yet. But I'm telling you, like, if you're ready for it, you feel like you want it, and it's, you got the right person and are in a relationship, and you have enough money, and all those things are ready to go, and you feel like you want to do it, then it's going to be incredible. It really is an incredible thing. I just don't recommend this for people that don't know. Like, you have to really want it, because then when you get it, it's all going to click.
Nice.
It is awesome, guys. And it feels right. And it, like I keep saying, it's the hardwiring. Like, there, things this good only come from hardwiring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has to be something that's already in there. So I just love it. My wife and I are just, our relationship is so much better now. And I don't mean it was bad. I just mean it, all of a sudden there's like 1,000 more colors in our relationship. They just weren't there before. And, you know, you sit around talking about your son and it's like, wow, I'm a dad. Like, what? You know, but I had these weird feelings. Like, my wife had like the nesting stuff. She was really like trying to like fix the house and get things lined up. And I'm just shitting a brick before the baby was born. And the baby was born, and all of a sudden, I'm like, caveman came out. I'm like, I have to, like, provide shelter and food and make sure the car's in awesome shape. And, you know, the garage door's broken. No, the garage door has to be fixed immediately. Like, it's like the weird stuff like that, where when I was, like, 25, like, the house could be on fire. And I'm like, I'll wait 5 more minutes. You know,
wait 5 more minutes to masturbate.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I got something else going on, so fuck that shit. But now it's you know, you just want to do it, and it's the thing that got your dad up to cut the lawn on the weekends. You know, it's that. It's awesome. You'll see. You'll remember this conversation.
Well, it's the selfish gene at work.
Yeah, it's powerful. It is the selfish gene at work, because you have to be this way. But you got to just go with it. That's the thing. We could sit here and analyze this stuff, and, you know, science is wonderful to help us see things in a way that we haven't and understand things. But you always have to remember that we're human and we're in this consciousness. You know, we're riding this thing that's being human, and it's fucked up and horrible sometimes. And sometimes it's just so good and so right. And having a kid is one of those times.
Damn you for making it sound actually fun.
It is. You know, and I could just keep going, and I'm sure you don't want this whole show about having kids. But it is fun. It is fun. And I'm like, I haven't even interacted yet, really. Like, he's smiling and like making the baby sounds at me, and I know he knows. I know that he sees me and all that, but I can't wait until, like, I'm going to talk to that guy. I'm going to have conversations with him. I get to tell him about the stuff that I'm freaking out excited about, which is going to help me like appreciate the stuff I like even more because I get to share it with someone that I love. But those conversations that I have with my kid, I guarantee you that like those will be the best times of my life, and they're ahead of me. So I'm really excited to think of my life that way.
And then you'll die.
Yeah, we're all going to die.
That's fucked up.
We're all going to die. No, it's. I think about... Do you guys think about death, like, ever? And if you do, how often do you think about it?
I do, and I'd say once or twice a month, but nothing too deep, usually. Like, I've been dead far longer than I've been alive. I don't really see a use of worrying about it.
It periodically, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think as I get older and I'm seeing, like, when you get into your 40s, a couple of things happens. Like, one, you're... The friends that never could get their shit together finally self-destruct. Hmm. And it's pretty funny because I've talked to quite a few people about this, and a lot of my other friends have experienced this with other friends of theirs that I don't know. And it seems to be like a good rule of thumb that I've established. And what you find is you'll find a lot of these people that, you know, they didn't know what they were doing in their 20s. They faked it through their 30s. But when your 40s come, you can't really fake it anymore. It just becomes obvious. Like, that guy is never going to get his shit together. It's over. You know? And you'll see it. And if you, anybody that's listening to your show that's in their 40s, like, think about it. Like, think about your friends. You know, hopefully you're not going to have to think about yourself. But think about your friends. And you'll identify the ones that are really just done, and they're in their 40s, and you can, because that's when it just becomes really obvious. So, I find that to be really interesting. And I find, as a, you know, I think about death quite a bit. Like, I've always been like fascinated and horrified by it, but now that I'm in my 40s, like, I'm seeing some of my friends self-destruct, and you know, I'm at that layer now where like people in my parents' age range are dying.
Yeah,
and that happens in your 40s and 50s for the most part. So I'm thinking about it a lot, and I think about it as a way to encourage me to be better at my life and be more enthusiastic. And I also think about it because it scares the hell out of me, and I don't like it. You know, I just don't like the whole thing, the whole concept of dying. Like, people try to, you know, talk to me about it, saying it's part of life or whatever. And like, to me, like, death doesn't really have anything to do with life, because it, you know, even though it is a part of the life-death process, death is not life, and it's not a part of the life system. It's the part of you not existing anymore.
Right.
You know, you get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have, you know, like you're saying, when I'm dead, I won't know it. And I probably won't know the moment that I die anyways. And death as a factor for motivation just doesn't do it for me. But knowing that this is the only life I have, that's my motivation.
Yeah,
to always go out and do something.
That's similar. I mean, it's pretty much, to me, the same thing. Like, yeah, this is it. This is my only life. This is the one turn around the wheel. And, you know, making it count is good for me. And hopefully the stuff I'll do will be good for other people. You know, and that's a huge motivator for me as well. But I have, you know, I don't know if you guys know, but like, I'm getting frozen when I die. And my wife is actually doing it now, too. And, you know, I know that statistically, the chances are probably almost zero. But it really is the only thing I can do as a huge protest to the idea that everyone is wrong with them being okay about dying. Like, I don't think it's okay. It's not okay. It's the worst thing that can happen to you.
Well, I watched my grandparents get into their 90s. By the time my grandpa died, he was 97 years old. He'd experienced everything he could have experienced in his life. It was an incredible story, but it had to have an end. And he was also just so incredibly decrepit. He was 97 years old. His body was shot. His mind was shot. And it was the appropriate time.
Sure. Now, I don't disagree with the whole idea of, like, you know, we get older, we end up being in pain. And, you know, I have, my parents are late 70s and early 80s, and I've had my grandparents already go through their 90s, and that's awesome that your grandfather lived into his 90s. Like, that's a great age to get to, as long as, you know, you're there on some level. And, I, you know, I'm seeing people that I love a lot, like, get into, like, that could die at any point now. Like, my dad's in his early 80s, and, you know, he can have a heart attack and be dead tomorrow, and that's it. The idea, though, is, you know, I'm not saying, like, we should be old forever. Like, if in the future, when we engineer out the problem of death, like, it's really, it is like a biological engineering issue, that something mm-hmm. that could be solved. Future technology is going to solve it. I mean, you know, just a matter of how many years do you think it's going to take? 50, 100, 200, however many years it takes, somebody is going to figure out all the things that the components of aging and solve them. Knock them down like bowling pins, and we're going to have people that are going to die only when, like, they get blown up at some point.
Well, and if you look at it from a evolutionary standpoint, there's been no evolutionary pressure to deal with aging or death. Anything that happens past, you know, more than a couple of years past puberty is completely irrelevant from an evolutionary standpoint. Yep. You've passed on your genes, with the exception of
possibly
women being able to actually raise their children. There's no significant evolutionary benefit. And so now that comes to, if you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, those self-actualization goals at the very top, we've got basic survival down. Now it's time to worry about some of those other things, like slow down aging.
I totally see what you're saying. And, you know, evolution, people bring that up a lot in this discussion, and I do have this discussion, you know, more than I actually would like to, because I argue with people a lot about this. But, you know, there are different perspectives, absolutely. But I think we all agree, when we die, lights are out, nobody is left, mm-hmm. you're done, you're in oblivion. And, you know, we don't know where the universe came from. We don't know where it's going to go, other than maybe heat death, probably. You know, it's going to turn into this warm nothingness. But, you know, let's be selfish for a moment, right? So right. I'm alive 80 years. 40 of them are probably awesome. Like, the middle 40 are, like, really awesome. Because you don't really, you know, other than being a really young kid, like, you're really not even conscious when you're in that age mm-hmm. range, you know. And then when you're really old, like, you're lamenting, like, your life's gone and you can't run anymore and do all the stuff that you don't have the energy and all that. So, you know, 40, 50 years, it's not a lot of time. It really isn't a lot of time, especially when we know that the universe is billions of years old. It's going to be around for a lot longer than it's already been here. And, you know, we're gauging things like other people on the planet, and, you know, we got to share the world. And all, well, you know, last I checked, the universe is pretty damn huge. These are all just technological problems. These aren't, like, evolution is meaningless mm-hmm. at this point for us. Like, who cares? Like, I don't care about evolution. I care about the historical relevance of it, but I don't give a fuck about evolution when it comes to, like, me dying. Like, evolution didn't think of me dying. I'm thinking of me dying. You know, like, so I'm a human, I'm conscious, I have intellect, and I'm telling you right now, like, I don't want to just live in the prime of my life for 40 years. That's nothing. I'm barely going to, like, do anything. I'm barely going to do this stuff that I could do. So sure, when I'm 80 and 90, I'm going to be in pain. Then I'm going to be like, yeah, I don't want to do this anymore. But right now, I'm in the prime of my life, and I've never been more at the top of my game. And I'm getting a lot of great stuff done, and I'm really enjoying myself. And, like, why can't it be like this for 1,000 years? At least I could do a lot of stuff and learn a lot of stuff and become a lot of stuff. And it doesn't have to be so limited. It's just limited because we're limited. It's not limited for any other reason other than it just is. And I just want to take that just is and say, it's going to be this now. It's not going to be the 50 years that randomness gave me. It's going to be me saying, I want to live longer, and I'm going to live longer.
So, just for a quick question, would you prefer to be a Futurama head in a jar, or more like a cyborg? Like, what? Brain memories, like, put into a mechanical body?
Well, Wesley, there's a big question. I mean, do I have a penis as a cyborg?
Yes. There you go.
I mean, the cyborg, you know, I mean, that's an easy question, because the head in the jar thing is more, it's a joke, you know,
sure.
It's the mockery of the people that want to live forever, immortalists and all that stuff. Sure. And it is kind of funny. And, you know, I might believe me, I have a couple of friends in particular that just will never not ride me about, like, you're going to wake up and they called me the, you know, I'm three quarters Italian. So they call me Italian Ice. because I'm going to be put on ice. And nice. They joke around about how I'm going to be like some robot bitch of some family in the future that paid to get me unfrozen and reanimate me, you know, all that stuff. I hear all that all the time. But the real deal is, like, sure, if it was still me, if it was actually my consciousness and not some reconstruction of my consciousness, but actually like the continuity that I have day in and day out today, and I could be in a cyborg body, like, I don't care. I'd be perfectly happy with that. You know, I mean, biology is great when you're young and it sucks when you're old. At least when you're a cyborg, you know, you have more control, or, you know, maybe you're an android type thing that, you know, like, in the end, like, I just want to be in something that's autonomous. And I'd be interested to talk about the variables of that. Like, cause like, all right, like, you want to trip out, like, I'll throw some really wacky shit at you. Your brain can map all sorts of stuff that aren't currently mapped. Like, right now, your brain is mapped to give you agency. Like, you know, you're inside your body. Yep. You understand that your finger stops and the world begins. Like, you know, you're not unclear about where your body is and isn't. Like, you know precisely where it is and pretty much. You know, and everything I'm saying here, people actually have a problem with. There are mental disorders, and, you know, you can get brain damage and lose these abilities. But these are all built-in components. We have modules in our brain that do these different things. You know, you have a part of your brain that's processing the environment around you and helping you make sense of that, so you feel like your place in it, and you know how big you are compared to everything else and all that stuff. But your brain is really, it's plastic. It's malleable. And you could actually have your brain, with training and with the use of it, like, if we were able to genetically engineer a hand that had 10 fingers, your brain could map it, could grow it and map it and learn to deal with it. And it would feel normal to you after a while. And your brain could be comfortable with and map an organ that's coming out of your body, like a tail or, you know, anything. Like, our brains can do this stuff already without us having to do anything. It's just built that way. It's built to be able to handle those types of things for some reason. I'm sure my brother Steve could explain why it does those things. But, you know, we could very easily have two sets of arms and our brains could map it. So it's just a matter of, you know, I'm not saying I want that, but it's just an idea. It's like, as a thought experiment, we could
As long as you put the organics in place and put the network through there, you know, you can pass the signals along and it'll just work after a time.
Your brain will make it work.
And I just think that's easier as a child. Well, but you could still do it as an adult.
Yeah. I agree. I think a child's growing brain is more adaptable and shapeable, sure. But even still, like, you know, there are people that have strokes and their brain remaps things and they can get back. And, you know, it's pretty interesting how flexible the brain is. And I don't really understand why, but it's just fascinating that, like, our primary organ can do all this stuff. And, you know, what would it be like if we could add limbs or do things to ourselves and have our brains be able to shape around that and conform to those things if we had the control? Or, you know, at some point, people are definitely going to be augmenting, like, their memory capacity and stuff with a brain computer interface. And, you know, it's going to get freaky. It's going to get really strange. But that's what's going to happen. These things are going to happen, guys. You know, no matter what you and I sit here and talk about today, humans are going to keep pushing technology and augmenting themselves and doing this crazy stuff. And I don't want to miss it. I don't want to be the one or two generations that made it, that didn't make it. You know, like, my son might live a million years. You know, like, technology, the singularity, whatever. Who knows what's going to happen 100 years from now? And I might miss it. And that it makes me really sad, and it kind of blows my mind, because I don't want to miss the opportunity to live 1,000 years and learn how to skydive and snorkel and do all the other stuff that people are going to be doing in the future. Just, I want it.
Actually, I'm really curious about that. Say that you and your wife are both being froze. Is there any, like, a clause in the contract on, like, how or who could thaw you?
Yeah, so there's different organizations out there that do this. I'm signed up with a company called Alcor, and they've been
the originals, pretty much.
Well, they got in the game very early, and there were other. Yeah. People trying to do it in other organizations that failed, and there were some really weird stories about, like, this guy that was trying to do it, and, you know, like, people thawed out in his driveway, and, you know, it just wasn't real. Like, Alcor's real. Like, they have real scientists. They have, you know, that they're constantly upping the game of their technology, and they're banking on other research that much bigger companies are doing, and you know, with preserving organs and you know, it's like biological antifreeze that they use, so you don't get like crystal constructs in your the fluids that are left in your body and all that stuff. Like this, you know, it's a very complicated thing. What they're trying to do is make it so your brain tissue doesn't crack and crystallize and do all sorts of nasty stuff as it's being dropped down to like minus 172 degrees. Probably it's not going to work. You know, I'm fine with that. You know, I at least I realize it and I'm accepting it. But if it does work and they're able to thaw that out and with nanotechnology, you know, rebuild somebody's brain a couple of hundred years from now, whenever it's going to be, and that's that person, well, that's epic. And that's really cool. And then you never know. In our lifetime, they might come up with warm storage. You know, don't have to get frozen. You might change the whole thing. You know, Alcor could, you know, be involved in new research and technology where they're room temperature storing people, and it just not the you know, the biology isn't decaying with chemicals or whatever it is. That would significantly increase the chances of you surviving it.
Right.
So Alcor has like a whole process in place. You know, they have different funds that you pay into for yourself. So you have like the part of the money goes to bringing you back. Part of the money is towards maintaining you while you're frozen. And yes, of course, lots of things can happen. The company could go bankrupt, or, you know, there could be a volcano erupts and destroys the facility, all these different things. Sure. I'm like, it's the yearly cost for me is minimal. I started paying this when I was 30. To me, it's like an adventure. Like, if it works, great. I spend a lot more money on coffee in a year than I do on getting frozen. And I don't really need either of them. But the frozen thing might work. And if it does, then I'll contemplate this for 1,000 years on the other side.
Sounds kind of like Pascal's wager.
Why not? I mean, you know, really, I don't care enough about money where I'm like, I'm not throwing away an enormous amount of money. I buy an insurance policy, so I'm just putting money into an investment. And I have tons of investments, and I think I'm worth maybe statistically improbable, but maybe future, sure, I think it's worth the gamble. You know, and it's not for everybody, absolutely, but I want to like change the public perception on this whole acceptance of death nonsense. I think it's ridiculous. Like we shouldn't accept death. It's like I said, it's the worst thing that'll ever happen to you. Your library of information is gone, and all the relationships and all the wonderful things that you experienced and all the wisdom that you've gained and all the fun, cool things that you could experience, it's all gone, just gone. And it doesn't make any sense. And that's all I got to say about that.
Well, all right.
The one thing with freezing that, cause I did watch a video on this recently on YouTube from I forgot her
some
name.
Guy.
Anyway, it was on YouTube, and it was an interesting video. Went into quite a bit of detail on the chemicals you're using and the freezing process. And I think they said it was either 48 or 72 hour freezing process to get to that minus 172 or whatever it was.
Yep.
My concern is that initial step in the freezing sounded a little bit too fast, and my concern would be the viability of the proteins and whether or not they're being folded too fast. And if you fold proteins too fast, they have a tendency to break.
Yeah, I've read some stuff about that, and they've been tweaking the process since they started the organization. They're constantly, you know, coming up with new techniques and studying like what's happening and how fast should things go. And you know, it's like you're on a very short leash in a way, you know, like you can't let things go too long and you can't let them go too fast. And, you know, introducing chemicals into the process to help things along. And I think that they've got the process of cooling the body down and taking it down to 172 degrees. Like I think they've done a very good job of maximizing preserving the tissue. But like I said, when new chemicals come into play, you know, they'll change their systems to take advantage of all the new chemicals and technology and whatever comes along to help. And, you know, ultimately, you know, it is a gamble. Like, sure, there are things that they're doing that are doing damage to your body. Of course. I mean, you know, you're dead. You really are, you're not conscious. And are you dead? Well, death is defined by, you know, is there any way that you're going to come back? So, for all intents and purposes, you're dead, but they might be able to bring you back. So you're not really dead. You're like in death stasis, if that's the right way to put it. And, you know, if I'm more concerned not about like my bicep and the protein in my bicep, but like, I'm concerned about the wiring connections in my brain. Like they need to be able to fix that and get that in a healthy state. Like, you know, everything else in your body is just a mechanism. It's just a machine. Your heart, whatever. There's no consciousness there. There's nothing there other than just this thing that's meant for plumbing. But your brain is you. That's your wiring. That's where your seat of consciousness is. And that's the thing that is of maximal concern is the preservation of that tissue. And they focus mostly on that, of course. Like, I'm actually getting a neuro, which means they're not going to save my body. They're just going to freeze my head. That's why, you know, they call me the Italian Italian ice and all that. Like my head's a popsicle, but you know, I know that they're going to need nanotechnology to pull this off. And with nanotechnology, like rebuilding a human body at that level is going to be trivial. Like that's going to be pretty easy compared to what they're going to have to do in my head to fix things. So I just did, you know, I just like, whatever, just build me a new body out of raw material and it'll genetically be mine, but it won't be this body. Did you expect this to be a lot more about like swearing and, you know, just being idiots?
Yeah,
like,
boy.
No.
I was figuring all the things you can't get away with saying on the SGU.
Well, let's do that for a little while. take me some dirty place, guys. Let's go somewhere dark.
Wait, do you want dark or dirty or
whatever? Both. Like, let's just go somewhere that isn't the SGU.
I mean, I sure, yes. I want to ask about your childhood in a while, but how did you pick your life? I mean, you're a programmer, right?
Yeah, I've been programming since my late 20s. It took me a while to grow up. I was the last, you know, I'm the youngest of five kids. And it's pretty typical for like a large family, like the youngest is a kind of off the rails because the parents get worn out and, you know, it's just like, so much going on. Yeah, it's just sad, but it's true. And they were like, I was like that kid, like I couldn't make my bed when I was 9 years old. I'd freak out. Like I just had no responsibility and I was off the rails pretty much. And not bad. You know, I wasn't like careening out into a drug induced stupor or anything, but I was just, you know, zero responsibility. I had a ton of friends. I was having fun all the time. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of like work hard and learn your work ethic. And my first real job was I worked on the dump truck for my dad's construction company. And it was hard as hell. I mean, it was like, oh my God. But I learned, I started to learn like, you know, this is a real job. This is like, you know, and I kind of got into it after a while and realized like it was fun to accomplish hard work and to do stuff and see the you know what you did, you know. But it didn't help that much because I didn't really grow up until I hit around 30. And that's when I really started to work on my life and work on my career and everything. So I got away with my 20s pretty much unscathed. I got into programming. I just decided I was either going to teach or be a programmer. There was the two things that were really interesting for me. And I realized that, you know, I saw the internet coming and I wanted to get into it. I really knew it was going to take off. I knew the internet was going to be a game changer. So that was it. I got into programming and like a year later I started a company and my partner and I started a company called Bear Claw Software. And we were writing custom software and we were helping other software engineers find work. So we were like, you know, we were working as technical recruiters as well. And that part of the business actually took off like crazy. This was before the internet bubble. And we made a ton of money the first couple of years of business. And then the internet bubble popped and everything, including my dreams of owning my own company, just, you know, blew up in my face in like 3 months. It was over. That sucked. Yeah. If I got in like 3 or 4 years earlier, we may have been able to make it through. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the technical recruiting part of it, you know, still a lot of people do it and there's a lot of money in it. You just have to have the connections and all that. And I was building that repertoire of connections because I was actually like getting jobs as a programmer in a company. And then I was working it from the inside. Like I was going to hiring managers and like, you know, I work there. I could walk up to people and say, hey, you know, you get to know someone, then you're like, I got a guy that could do that job. And you're like, they know you. And they're like, oh, really? Oh, yeah. And there you go. And we just started like loading these companies up with programmers. It worked so well. It was ridiculous. So, but, you know, that came and went. And then I just started working as a consultant and finally landed my current job. I didn't want to work as a consultant anymore because it was like too on and off. And right now I work at a company called Thule, and they make like all the cargo carriers, like sporting goods equipment and everything. And it's a global company owned by a Swedish company. And, you know, I work for the North America division as a senior software engineer. And I've been doing that for about 5 years. And, you know, it's a career that I'm kind of getting tired of. I need to grow. I need to grow in this career. And the thing is, the SGU has been, it takes up all of my free time. It really
that's gotta
does.
Be a hell of a, that's got to be a hell of a way to network around, though, if you want to get into another career at some time.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, what happened over the last couple of years was Steve and I decided that we want to try to make the SGU become more of a full-time job. And it's different. You know, Steve's a clinical neurologist, and he works for Yale, and he can't really, like, take 6 months of work off and then go pick up his career again. Like, I could quit my job, work for 6 months, say, doing something else, and then go right back into what I'm doing somewhere else, and it's fine. As long as I can show that I did something worthwhile on my resume, it's okay. Steve can't do that.
Yeah.
And you know, we want to do skepticism full-time, and we want to produce content full-time. And I think, you know, we've proven that we have the chops, and we can do it, and we can do it in multiple types of media. It's just really hard to make money. It's a very difficult thing, you know, when we're pretty much, I wouldn't consider us grassroots at all anymore, but in a way we're a grassroots organization. You know, we're not funded by anybody, any big corporations or any, you know, big multimillionaires that believe in what we're doing. You know, none of that's happening. Like, we're really earning the money, and it's a hard earn. You know, like, if I spent all the SGU time on my career, I'd be making five times the amount of money I'm making. Like, I could be a VP or a president of a company at this point, but I decided to do it with the SGU. That's where I want my life to go. And it's not just the SGU, but it's the skeptical activism. It's the education activism. It's all of that stuff that really drives me. That is the driver of my life.
You got your own locals, your own local skeptical groups. You've also got Nexus. I mean, you guys stay busy.
Oh yeah. There's an endless amount of work. It's more about, you know, can you feed your family on this stuff? And it's hard because, you know, what are you going to do? Like, we need a product. That's the real deal. And the product can be a lot of different things, but, you know, podcasts today really aren't products. You know, I'm trying to monetize the show right now. We've been, you know, done a ton of research, and I found a company that's going to help us put ad placements in the podcast. And that could bring some money. You know, the bigger the audience, the better. You know, but I want Steve to finish writing books. Like, he's got 5 books he's working on right now, and he can't finish any of them because of the SGU, to be honest with you. It's like, we don't have enough free time. So we're trying to figure out ways to make money to buy us the free time to get to the next level, and it's just proving to be very difficult.
Yeah, that would be.
So, you know, ultimately, we're trying to build a brand and build a media, I don't want to say empire because it sounds so pretentious, but we're trying to build a media company that produces certain types of content, and I just, you know, there's so much stuff that we come up with that we just don't have the time to do. But if I were more of a producer, and working in that capacity, you know, I literally right now have like 4 podcasts that I want to launch that I think would be phenomenal ideas. And they're not just science-based. They're different types of podcasts. I just, you know, I need the right people, and I need the money to do it, and I need the time to make it happen. It's just not going to happen, not with a full-time job. It's just not ever going to take place. And like our OCK, the Skeptical Caveman shoot that we're doing over the next 3 months, you know, it's just so much time, you wouldn't believe it. The pre-production and everything. Yeah, it's taking over my free time. Like, my wife and I are literally like changing the baby's diaper, and we're talking about costuming and talking about the scripts, and it's become a part of our daily lives. And I just don't want my life to be like this anymore. Like, I want to do it full time, and I'm trying to connect the dots, and I do see a way to get there. I really do. It's just gonna take more time though. So I'm going to continue to push the ball forward for the SGU and see what we can do for another few years.
How many downloads does your average episode get?
Sick.
Yeah, we're between like 100 and 125 that we can track. But recently, working with the ad agency and just trying to get like
100 to 125,000.
Yeah, yes. 1,000 a week. So what happens is, like, as we look at the aging report of each episode, like, the initial downloads start in like the 70,000 range, and then it gets up to those numbers in about 3 weeks. And those are all unique downloads. But it was interesting talking to the ad agency because they work with podcasts, and they were saying, you know, what about like your lateral penetration, which is, and I was like, you know, what do you know about lateral penetration? And the guy said, I actually said that, and I was joking, and he was like, excuse me? And I'm like, no, go ahead. What were you saying? But
yeah, he probably wasn't expecting a sex joke.
No, not at all. But, you know, he's saying, like, you know, we have people that download our show and listen to it with their spouse or their kids or their coworkers. Like, one guy emailed us recently saying, you know, I got 10 people at work listening to my single download. So there's probably a lot more ears hearing our show than, you know, say average 125,000. But it only, you know, it's the clicks that count. It's the physical download that counts. So I really can't say anything beyond that, but it's probably more, but you know, still it's a lot of people, you know, we do have a very rich audience, meaning, you know, not money wise, but just, you know, a lot of people out there, a lot of happy listeners and people that appreciate the work that we do. And it's literally, guys, I mean, we haven't missed a week in 8 years. It's just, we love it. We love doing it. We love the work that it takes. And we love the feeling that we get when we make people happy with the show. So
now I have to say that is incredibly impressive.
Stamina is important in all things in life. And I know that's
so,
not, it's so funny,
true. But
it's true. I mean, you get into a career in your life and you need to stick with it and work your ass off, and it should take you places. And it's, you know, podcasting is no different. I mean, Steve said this way before I knew it to be 100% true, and it was literally like within the first month of us doing the show. Steve's like, we can't miss a week. We can't. We have to let people know we're always going to be here, and we're always working on the show because they'll feel us there. They'll expect us there, and they'll anticipate us being there. And he was so right. It was ridiculous. Yeah. It's just I admire my brother so much for so many things, and he's gotten so many things right. And in the podcasting, he was so right. I mean, he wrote the show. And he wrote the show, the exact format that we have. Like, he sat down and wrote it, and that was it. And it's the SGU. It's this show. How? I mean, if you left the show up to me, like, I would have been kicked off podcasting, like, you know, 6.5 years ago. They would have just been like, you can't podcast anymore. You're, you know, you just need help. Go see a doctor. Because I come up with the craziest shit, especially in the beginning. I was just like, my ideas were insane. You know, I just wanted to, like, go nuts on the show. And now, like, I actually, the stuff I do on my own, like episode 400, I wrote that intro. I don't know if you guys heard it, but it was like that fake NASA thing. Like, that's the kind of stuff I write now. And that's because of Steve. Like, Steve honed me down to like this really efficient, smart thinking guy that can come up with stuff like that. But I wasn't like that 8 years ago. I was bad. I really had bad ideas. So it feels good. Feels good to sit back and realize that I have a skill set that I didn't have. But it's a lot of work, guys. It's really, it's a ton of work, man. And my wife right now, as I sit here with you guys, my wife is sitting in a room not too far away with my child and just saying, I wonder when Jay's going to get done and spend some time with me. Really, like, that's the sacrifice it takes. You know, she has to be okay with it. And luckily she is, and she gets it. And even still, it sucks. You know, I don't get to watch TV shows with my wife at night. You know, barely.
Yeah, you're not missing anything.
And I know that too. You know, at the end of my life, I can look back on my catalog of work and be really proud of it. But I enjoy this, though, and that's the other thing. She gets it. She knows that this isn't just work. I love doing this, and it wouldn't work if I didn't love it. But there are sacrifices to any success along the way. You know, unless you hit the lottery, you've had to kill yourself to get somewhere. And it's important to want to do it. It's important to really love and be passionate about the stuff that you choose. Because, man, you know, 8 years from now, am I still going to love to do this? Well, I made the right decision 8 years ago to commit myself to the show. I think I got lucky. You know, how many people get to do something that they love for 8 years and have it actually mean something? I'm so lucky. You know, I'm so fortunate to have the people that I have that I do this with.
It's got to be really cool to be able to work with your brothers like this too.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's the familial thing has really, that was one of the core elements of the SGU that make it sing, is that we have this really awesome rapport and dialogue with each other. And like the all those funny bits and the stuff that like makes people feel like they're part of the conversation just happens to be like my really zany Italian family talking at the dinner table. Like, that's our banter.
So now I need to know, though, how was Steve as an older brother when you were kids? Was he picking on you? Was he a good kid? Was he a nerd? What was he? Well, like, did you get picked on? You were the baby and all.
Yeah, I mean, picked on is maybe not the right way to put it. Like, I was more of like the epic pain in the ass to my older brothers and my sister.
What was the age difference there?
My brother Bob is a twin. He's not an identical twin, but he and my brother Joe are going to be 50 this year, and I'm going to be 45 this year. Steve's 3 years older than me. And then we have an older sister who is 54. I'm the youngest, and Bob and Joe are the next step, and then Steve. But Steve seems like and acts like the real older brother, you know? Steve matured very early and became Steve very early in his life. I butt heads with Steve a lot when we were kids. I always loved him, and I'll keep saying it. Like, it was never a lack of love. Like, I never had, like, that hate relationship with anybody in my family. But I was an epic pain in the ass. Like, bad. Like, I would break into his... He had to, like, put a padlock on his closet because I would mess him up with his stuff. And I break into his closet in his bedroom and get all of, like, his, like, comic books and, you know, Spy versus Spy and BC and all these, like, you know, all these awesome, like, at the time, there were just these awesome books that I had to get my hands on. And I would break their toys and, you know, I lived in a very low consequence world. I'll put it that way.
So you got away with a lot of shit. All right.
But I'll tell you what we did do that always was awesome was that we talked. And we talked about, like, the movies that we went to see. My dad always started dialogues with us about, like, made us talk. He just made us examine the thing. You know, what'd you think about that movie? What'd you think about these characters? What'd you, you know, and always wanted us to think for ourselves. And my dad, you know, the hobbies that we did were not TV-based hobbies. They were, like, we would build remote control airplanes, and we would... you know, we'd be out in the yard, like he'd help us build tree forts, and it was always active and thinking. You know, my dad bought a snowmobile, and we always had that, and we'd drove that snowmobile into the ground, you know, and it was like everything was an adventure, and it was always like joking and making fun of each other, and you know, and it just transitioned right into the podcast. Like, as soon as we got comfortable talking into the microphones in this format, you know, the personality, the family thing came out, and it worked. It just was easy. And the next thing I know, like, we're talking and 2 hours would go by and we're just joking around, talking about these news items that we would be talking about anyway, you know? Mm-hmm. So it just came pretty easy to us as far as that aspect of it. But everything else, the management of the show and then we got into more and more detailed research, and we all learned how to do research and learned to have, you know, protocols in place to make sure that we're doing things correctly. I just like had a major mistake on the last show. Like, I screwed up the Bitcoin discussion on, I think it was episode 402 or 403 maybe. I talked about Bitcoin and I got a lot of data wrong, and it was a lot of reasons why it came out bad. And Steve and I had a 2-hour discussion about where I dropped the ball, for real. And it was just one news item, and Steve and I went through it and picked it apart and figured out like where I made mistakes, why the research didn't happen as well as it could have, and you know, and Steve is so good at doing research. Like, he's constantly my teacher when it comes to this stuff. All of us, he's taught us all how to do research. I mean, Rebecca really was very good when she came to the show, but he's always there to help us be better at doing it, because like he's just got that mind, and he's, you know, in order to be a doctor, you have to know how to research. It's part of the job, or it should be part of the job. So what we decided to do was we're going to turn the Bitcoin mix up, is what I'll call it. We didn't really hit the facts correctly enough. We're going to turn that into a lesson on the show. We're going to talk about like what mistakes I made, what I did to correct, you know, what I, not only what I did that was wrong, but how I took steps to correct them. And then I'll present the fixed data and explain to people, like, you know, all right, I made all of these missteps and I made all these wrong assumptions about the websites that I was going to. And I relied on Wikipedia too much and I didn't go back to the original source. I didn't ask people that I knew that were experts. I didn't reach out to an expert. I was in a time crunch because we were putting together two shows at Nexus in the same day. We did two full shows in the same day. And I was like, that's like, you know, damn. I told Steve that. Steve, but we did two full shows in the same day. And he's like, this is exactly what Steve said. Do you think our audience gives a fuck? Literally. He's like, they don't care. Jay, what are you going to like get on the show and say, woe is me, I actually was busy. Like, they don't care. You have to hit the ball. That's Steve. You know, that's behind the Steve. And it's awesome because he's right. Not only is he right, but I was actually making excuses, you know, and he's like, nobody gives a shit. Excuses are meaningless. You have to be correct every time. And he's right. Right?
Yeah,
and you know he's right.
120,000 people don't care that you were busy.
It's true. He will not let us throw an excuse out on the show. Like, it doesn't work. They don't want to hear that. I'm just trying to make myself feel better. So now I have to take it on the chin and I have to tell people like what mistakes I made and why. Cause it actually, I didn't do a good job. I did a bad job and I haven't done a bad job on a news item in a long time, but well, I did a bad job.
That's pretty much standard fare for the internet though. 10,000, you know, you fucked ups and, you know, 10 or 100, you know, good jobs.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. It's easy to have the successes looked over and have people write in and be pissed off about mistakes that I made. And I had a lot of people write in that were willing to help, which was nice, but I'm mildly embarrassed about it because I have to hold up a standard. But at the same time, you know, we're real people and, you know, we're going to use me as an example of even when you know what to do, you screw up. And these are like simple, basic mistakes that I knew better. And it's fun, you know. I mean, it's not like I'm not like losing sleep over it. I just,
sure,
I'm upset with myself. I should not have scheduled myself to be so busy that I couldn't produce excellent content. And really, that's what it takes. That's the dedication that it takes. I have to make myself be angry at myself to hold the quality level up high enough for it to go. And I was listening to a podcast recently by Alec Baldwin. It's called Here's the Thing. And it's a great podcast, by the way. He's a very good interviewer. And he was talking to Alec Baldwin was interviewing David Letterman. And David Letterman was talking about how he would work 20 hours a day on his show. That's what it took to become the original David Letterman and all the work that it took to get him to that level. And it was literally like he said physically, I can't do these shows anymore. I can't be that guy anymore. Like he has other people write the content now. And when he said that, I was like, oh my God, like, yes, I get that. Like I'm there. I'm living that right now. Like you can't drop the ball. Like he had to work that hard in order to get the content to the level that it needed to be. You know, so like when I'm talking earlier about the conversation comes easily, yes, it comes easily, but I have to build a building in order to take the elevator up to the top floor to have the conversation on. you know what I mean? Like there is so much work that goes into getting to there that by the time we're talking about the news items, it's easy and fun and we're just kind of unwinding the ball that we wound up. So, you know, you have to be consistent with that or else people are going to like people saw through my mistakes immediately. And I got dozens of emails like, wow, man, I'm disappointed. Jay, what's up? You like totally you bombed on this one. I'm like, oh, wow. Ow. Ow. I don't want to feel that way anymore. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen again.
Well, okay. The one time I've left you guys feedback, it was because you totally missed so much awesome material on the guy you're talking about.
What guy?
That was with John Harvey Kellogg. This is about a year ago.
We did an interview and we didn't ask him enough questions.
No, not an interview. It was, I don't remember which take you guys took on him. I think it was his pro-circumcision position and how it was completely bullshit. And completely missed that he was one of the leading proponents of what has become alternative medicine.
I actually, as strange as this sounds, I think I remember your email. And we get so many, but I remember us talking about that.
Or maybe it was the other way around. You got the alt med stuff and missed the. It was something that was missing that made it.
Yeah,
so much better.
I do remember that. And you know what it is too is there's a few things that happen. Like first off, we over record. Like we record more than is used. So you know, a lot of stuff hits the floor because we have to get our show down to an hour 20 minutes and then we have to get it down to just below an hour for the XML version of the show. So XML, the XM radio, XM Sirius radio. So there's a lot of stuff that he has to cut out. So Steve has to actually cut out swaths of conversation that, you know, instead of, he can't just like cut out every other minute. Like he's like thinking, okay, here's 20 minutes of a news item. I only want 7 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to cut out like conversations, not just, you can't say, and we hit this, this, and this. It's like, you just take the best bits or the most relevant bits, and then you cut out all this other stuff. And mixed with that other stuff is just me and Rebecca going apeshit. which is funny. You know, because we always like go off, run totally crazy tangents, and like, you know, and Steve's like, I'm just editing all of this stuff out in his head at, when we're doing it. So yeah, so like there are things that we talk about that we get to that the show just isn't long enough for Steve to add in. So like that's why sometimes there's gaps or people perceive gaps that weren't mm-hmm. there in the discussion. And I'll tell you though, yeah. it's really our fault because we should record the show like we're recording an hour and 20 minute show. We should be punchy and get to all of the facts that we need to. And a live show, we're a little bit better at it. But when we record our show, it's like we love it and we're just having fun. So we're just going off on any tangent that we want to. And it, sadly, maybe the show would be better if we didn't go off on all those tangents and we just focus down. Because we do miss segments of discussions because of that fact, everything I just described to you.
Yeah. Well, another option you guys could do is, and now granted, this would create a lot more work for Steve in editing, but do a premium version that is twice as long where you don't cut out as much.
Yeah, so this is part of me monetizing the show. So one of the ideas was we get a lot of people that say, I'm willing to pay for the extra content. Please give me a way to give you money by giving me something that I want. And we get emails every day. People ask for that. They want it. And we have some premium content. So one of the ideas is this. We're going to first pull the best bits out of the shows that we do, and we're going to make those available. And then we're also going to make available, we're going to record other segments of other, maybe a little bit off topic stuff. Like we want to do more movie reviews that people liked and, you know, mm-hmm. stuff that isn't relatively perfect for the SGU content wise, but it's still us talking in the manner that we do that people like. And we're just going to make that all pay per download. You can buy, you know, piece it or buy like, you know, a monthly subscription to this stuff. And you know, that's going to be something coming out soon that we hope that people are really going to enjoy. And it'll also allow us to talk about other stuff. Not just like SGU mm-hmm. premium, you know, good content. We're going to talk about just things that maybe are a little bit more out of the wheelhouse of skepticism.
Got to say the takedown on Prometheus was pretty fucking funny.
It was fun too. Yeah, it came out good because there was so much there. He fucked up in so many ways. It was just a train wreck.
It was a glory hole of explosive shit everywhere.
Exactly. It was awesome. Like when we saw that movie, like immediately Steve and I were like, we're going to rip that fucking movie to shreds on the show. Like it's perfect, but there's not that many of those epic fails that are perfect for us. It just doesn't happen that often. So that's why we're looking for other movies and we have a list, but they're really not, I don't think a lot of them are going to make the main show just because it's not perfect for the SGU. And we just really are very critical about the stuff that gets on the show.
All right. Cool. Changing it completely. Were you guys raised religious at all?
Yeah, so my mom pretty much was an atheist. I've come to learn from the beginning, and she just never said much. And my dad has maintained being Catholic, and we've pulled him. We had him in a good place for a while, and now that he's in his, you know, the last decade or so of his life, he's really becoming religious again as a coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. But we, you know, I was actually very interested in religion in early high school. Like I was in a private Catholic school, and I don't know why. Just like for about a year, I felt like very spiritual and religious. And what killed that, and it would have died anyway, but what killed it for real was that my sister became a born again Christian, and she went and you know, like you guys were saying before, speaking in tongues, and mm-hmm. I saw it all. Yep. I've lived it all. I saw this grown man sitting under the kitchen table in my parents' house, like sobbing, telling Jesus how much he loves him. And it just seems so profane to me. Like I was like, wow, these people are really weird. They're like, they're not just weird. They're creepy. They make me feel uncomfortable. And like, they're trying to push their religion on me so hard that the only thing that I can do at 14 was push back.
Yeah.
Because it was just wrong. Like, you're not supposed to come at someone that way to a 14-year-old and try to get them to believe what you're believing because you're, you know, and a lot of them, like, and look, I have friends that have beaten alcoholism and beaten drug addiction and everything. And sadly, a lot of my sister's friends at the time were all like ex-abusers that went to the church for help. And that was their like way of pulling themselves out of whatever it is that they were, you know, whatever their problem was. And it wasn't just substance abuse. It was people with emotional problems and all that stuff. But they run to this church, this extreme cult-like church, to help them because it sucks them in and they, you know, tell them what to do and what to think. So my sister, like, just handed me critical thinking on a silver platter, said, here is everything that you need to fight against and to sharpen your tools. And it happened to all of us. Steve was already on the path, but I really wasn't. But when this happened with my sister, it was just like, boom, like it just exploded. You know, next thing you know, I know how to argue against, you know, wacky thoughts, whether it's religion-based or not. Like, I just started to build this toolbox of, like, go-to ways of thinking about things and, you know, constantly trying to figure out, like, why they're wrong and coming back with really rational explanations, you know, and telling my sister, no, you didn't see heaven with a telescope. Like, you can't see. Seriously. Wow. And I had to tell her why it wasn't heaven. You know, they're seeing, like, you know, a dust cloud, a phenomenally huge dust cloud with a really primitive, telescope in the late 1970s or early 1980s. And they're like, that's heaven. And we're like, no, that's a dust cloud. That's like billions of stars or proto star. You know, like, we're trying to explain to her, like, physics and cosmology and science. And I didn't even know it. So I'm learning it and then immediately turning around 24 hours later and, like, telling other people about it. And it was awesome. It was awesome. It was so powerful. It was such an awesome way to get into all this stuff. Like, I was already into it, but I didn't, like, study it. I didn't get intimate with it until it was, like, my sword. Then I was, like, sleeping in bed with it. Then I'm like, science is, like, my boy, you know? So it was great, and it was scary, and I watched my sister do a lot of things that were painful to see her have to learn the hard way, and she got taken advantage of, and... You know, now it's like there are no religious discussions around our table. It just doesn't happen anymore. And she's still a born-again Christian, and she just doesn't really talk to us about it. But here's something that's really funny, guys. My sister is the skeptic of her group. She is the critical thinker. She's learned. She's actually listened. And she was telling me about 6 months ago about how all of her friends are like, Sandra, is this bullshit or is this real? And she'll, like, give them really good critical thinking examples of why it's right or wrong because she's been listening. And that blew my mind. I'm like, wow, like my born again Christian sister, who has been a huge influence on me becoming the level of critical thinker that I am, actually learned from us and is using it in her, you know, pseudo intellectual pursuit, which is
her.
How cool
is it that you're again having that effect right back on her, having, you know, being an influence on her and all of her friends. And hopefully
Wesley,
maybe see
I love
a chink
it.
In the armor.
I love it. I love it. It's awesome. You know, I know that she'll never get to where we're at, and she you know, doesn't want to be where we're at, but it makes me happy to think that, you know, she got something out of the stuff that we've been working on, and it has some meaning to her. You know, I mean, it is cool. It is cool. And I'm, you know, we have a better relationship now than we've ever had, other than when I was, like, you know, pre-14. And it's good. It has come full circle now. Like, I can respect the fact that it's important to her, and, you know, she needs it. On some level, absolutely. And, you know, like, I'm not going to take that away from her. Like, she doesn't want it. She doesn't want to think like I do. And I'm not going to force that on her, you know. Like I said, I'm all about the fence sitters. Give me fence sitters all day and I'll work on them happily. You know, I don't want to, like, go to someone like my sister and try to uproot the foundation that they've built their life on. That's not cool and it's not for me. I don't want that anymore.
But it is fun putting the chinks in the armor of those fence sitters, like you're saying.
Sure. And or if somebody comes at me, like, you want to argue with me and you're going to be, like, in my face, then, you know, you'll get 10 minutes of me, like, schooling you, and I'll do it and I'll be a little hard on them. Sure. But, you know, I'm not making progress. All I'm doing is, like, just listening to myself talk at that point. But
scoring points, hopefully, on the people that are watching.
Yeah. And it is. That's awesome that you say that. It's so, like, God. Everybody listening, that point is phenomenal. You are not talking to the person you're arguing with. You're talking to everybody that's in earshot. That's your audience. You always keep that in mind. You're never gonna win the guy you're debating. You're always gonna win the audience. They're gonna walk away going, "Oh, that guy made a lot of good points. That was wow. That got them thinking." Because they're not engaged in the drama. They're just listening to the drama. They're not a part of it. And it's so true. And that's all I do when I'm in a big discussion like that is I'm like, okay, so do I have anybody listening? Like, do I need to actually, am I fighting this guy or am I teaching the people listening? Or is there anyone that's going to listen to me? And that does change my stance significantly.
Yeah. Standard debate tactics, you know, judge your audience and play up to play with your strengths. What groups are you in? What pimp some stuff?
Like what groups, like what music, or what are you talking about?
No, sorry. Like, what skeptical, atheist, any kind of activist groups are you a part of? And, you know, how can people find them?
Yeah, so my primary outlet for the activism that I do, of course, is through the Skeptics Guide. So we have our podcast, and we're working on our Ock the Skeptical Caveman video. That's going to be, hopefully, we're going to start shooting sometime in May, or, you know, might have to push it depending on how pre-production goes. But that stuff's coming out soon. I will say that we have a secret project that we're working on that I can't give any more details on, but this could be something potentially very big for us that could be a game changer. But people should find out about that probably by the end of the summer. And that's taking up time. So other than the Skeptics Guide, though, I'm actually working on some personal stuff now that isn't SGU, but it is still skeptical related. So I'm working on a lecture. And I have a documentary that I want to make that I'm writing right now that has to do with kids. So those are some of my projects, which I'll be excited to talk about in detail more in the future. But other than that, man, just listen to the podcast and write in and let me know if you like it.
All right. Awesome.
Awesome. Well, we shouldn't take up any more of your time. So and thank you tell very
Courtney,
much.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Guys, thank you so much. I had a great time, and I realized how much of me you had to listen to talk tonight. I was like, I just use a lot of you guys listening, and you have awesome listening skills. So thank you. I had a great time.
All right, my man. All right. Thanks so much, Jay. It's been a pleasure, man.
You got it, guys. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
For music, we have Bleak Harvest by Scott Williams. And Scott's actually my brother. He's a member of the band Problems, based out of Portland. Check him out if you ever get a chance. But he does do some stuff on his own. And this song, Bleak Harvest, is a very nice example. And so this is all Scott, my brother. Sweet. Enjoy.
It's a bleak Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find us online at www.atheistnomads.com. Contact us at contact@atheistnomads.com or leave us a voicemail message at 541-203-0666. You can also like us on Facebook or leave us a review on iTunes, Zoom, or wherever else you find the podcast. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.
Oh, yeah!